I think that's a big mistake that a lot of people do. They just think the product is way more important than it actually is. Mm-hmm. Product has to be right, but your go-to-market is just really, really important. And I think that's what I took away from it. And it cost us a lot of money. And if my co-founder, Katharina, hears this, I'm really sorry about this.
Welcome to The Growth Show. What keeps us driving is what drives you further. This is your hosts, Sebastian Kunz and Sarah Kaya.
We are here today with Florian Schneider of Findling and Failing. Welcome, Florian.
Thank you.
So today I'm alone without Sebastian and have the pleasure of talking with an amazing Hamburg founder. So Florian, let's start with a short pitch of what you do. So who are you and what do you do for a living?
Okay, I'm Florian. I'm the founder of Findling, or it's Failing now, a company that has pivoted quite a lot. Well, I would probably give you more of like the story behind it than an actual pitch. I'm, you know, not really trying to sell, but that's probably just way more interesting to hear. Basically, we started our company in 2015. Which is actually 4 years ago now, actually quite some time. And we sort of had the dream that we wanted to help local stores to be more visible online. So you can imagine this kind of being like a digital shop window for shops where you could be looking for a certain brand. Like I'm seeing, I see you're wearing Nike shoes. You could be looking for Nike shoes, for example, and then find the local shop in your area that is selling Nike shoes. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we started that, and we did have some traffic starting off, some organic traffic on that, but we found out pretty quickly that the people were only looking for lifestyle products. So they weren't really looking for, I don't know, where can I buy Tupperware or something. It was like actual kind of fashion, designer gifts, and baby fashion lifestyle, you know, stores. Mm-hmm. Since our business plan was involving a lot of shops, since we were running a subscription model, we found out pretty quickly that it wasn't going to be successful with only lifestyle shops. That was kind of the moment when we thought, okay, we had to stop this because the market was just too small. Mm-hmm. Thankfully, a couple of brands actually came up to us, like, you know, like the Nike shoes you're wearing. Imagine a smaller brand from that section selling shoes, mm-hmm. Came up to us and were asking us, hey, can we run ads on your website? So we had no idea why they would do that, because basically, you know, we had like, I don't know, 5,000 unique visitors or 10,000 unique visitors a month. So why would you run ads on that?
Yeah.
And after meeting up with them, we found out they weren't interested in the end consumer using the website. They were interested in the shops that we had acquired for the website. Because what they wanted was to sort of have a wholesale platform where they could sell their shoes to the retail stores. Mm-hmm. So we're like, hey, that is interesting. That is kind of like a trade fair concept, just in a digital kind of way. So we started sort of, you know, building a platform around that, building a virtual trade fair is what we call it now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was still a windy road, but in the end, we're profitable now. And we're working in about 20 countries on the brand side and in the German speaking part of the European Union on the store side. And we're basically helping, you know, brands find new resellers for their products. And that's like, long story short, that's what I do now.
Awesome. So when did you actually pivot?
Yes, a good question. To be honest with you, the idea of pivoting was probably like after a year or something, but it was a pretty long and windy road still, because basically we did everything wrong. Well, there were a couple of things we did right, but that was by coincidence.
Yeah.
So we didn't really test our assumptions with little or no money. We just tried to gather as much money as we could from friends and family, which wasn't a lot, but you know, it was all we had. We started hiring a full-time developer straight away. Mm. We rented an office. Sort of our go-to-market plan was something like word of mouth, and we're going to become viral and we're going to get a lot of PR. So, you know, there wasn't really one. So yeah, we did a lot of like wrong things, but we still managed to squeeze out that MVP for that little pivoted, you know, project that we had. And we managed to get a couple of brands on it and a couple of stores, and it was vaguely working, but we didn't grow at all, basically. Yeah. So we did a lot of cold calling, and we did a lot of what else did we do? We send out newsletters and we tried everything, but we weren't really growing. And then I think it was about a year and a half ago when I sat down and I was like, well, I just got like 30 rejections from cold calls and, you know, I can't take it anymore, basically. And we virtually had almost no money left and we were doing agency work to, you know, kind of, you know, survive and all that. Yeah, and then I was like, okay, how do we spend the last 2,000 or 3,000 euros that we have right now? So I was like listening to a lot of podcasts, like you do. I was reading books and, you know, trying to figure out what we could do, and they weren't really helping me. So what I did, I sort of have a background in IT and maths and everything. So what I did, I sat down in my kitchen, had a beer, and thought about what do we really need to make more revenue. So I kind of developed kind of like a KPI model, if you want to call it that, where I could see how do social media followers in the end influence revenue. It's sort of like shaped like a tree, and we're still using that right now. And basically what I saw then was like, okay, there are a couple of factors that I can change. I was doing like everything altogether in the last month. So I was changing the product, I was changing the sales funnel, I was changing, I was hiring new people, and, you know, I was just doing a lot. And then I started actually doing just one or two strategic things a month, measuring them, seeing what the outcome was, and just sort of incrementally increasing revenue. And that was probably like a year or a year and a half ago about that. And that's when it sort of started to get better. And when we started to actually grow, we've actually 10x in revenue over the last 12 months, which I think is mostly because of we found a way to sort of measure how our changes affected the revenue in the end.
So it's the new model which 10x'd actually, not the old model, right?
Yeah, it's the basically the virtual trade fair that 10x'd, but it didn't do that by itself. It just did that because we sort of understood how we could, you know, measure the whole company and put it in a financial model, if you want to call it that, and then do incremental changes to actually, you know, increase revenue. Just to give you an example, we started off with one pricing. So if you were a brand, you had one pricing on the virtual trade fair, where you could stay on the platform for 6 months. That was basically it. So we're like, okay, you know what else we do? We just have a second pricing, so you can stay on the trade fair for 12 months. So there was no change in features at all. But, you know, some customers are willing to pay more. So that was the first change that we made that gave us more revenue. So that was like the start of everything. And then we were like, okay, that is working. What else can we do? Well, we just try to measure one thing this month. That is our sales conversion. So just try to get that better. So we went to Dirk Kräuter. Do you know Dirk Kräuter? It's like a big kind of famous German sales guy. I think it's like 4,000 people in a room and it's like 100 euros. And we just went there and tried to get the sales pitch right. And we did that and it increased conversion by 5%, you know. So the revenue went up again. And the next thing we were was we started doing doing social ads, you know, to get more leads, basically, and that increased again. And then we started to think about, okay, what product metrics are important for the user, and only change really subtle things to get the customer happiness, you know, better. By that time, we hardly spent any money at all on product development anymore. So it was mostly like really subtle changes, and that's when, you know, everything kind of took off, and we're like, okay, this is growing, we could start hiring people, and we're like, you know, almost 10 people now, which is still kind of small, but it's sort of a profitable running machine where I know how much money I can put in and how much comes out in the end, you know. And that was the thing I was missing for the first 3 years when running the company, basically.
What would you consider, besides of course revenue and maybe users, the most important KPI?
The thing is, I think it's important. There's one thing that I can maybe give, like, other people that, you know, that are listening to this, that I found out a couple of months ago. There's such a thing called vanity metrics. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah.
So that is basically when you are trying to measure product KPIs, what a lot of people do is measure absolute numbers, as in absolute numbers of users, as in absolute numbers of logins or something like that. That has to be a relative metric measured in accordance to users. So, for example, logins per user. Otherwise, you're not actually measuring your product development team. You're just measuring your sales team again.
Yeah.
And then every metric becomes a sales metric, you know?
Yeah.
So that was a really important learning I had in the past months, for example. If you want to like read all about it, there's a website that we developed, which is called leantree.de/case study. And there you can read basically everything that we did to get our KPIs up and how we changed like small things in the company to get our revenue up. And I will say something about that in there as well. But yeah, that's something that I think was very important to us and that we had to learn. Because as it turned out, before we knew that, the past year, we didn't really make any positive changes according to product. We just got more user on the product, you know, but the product wasn't really getting any better.
Yeah.
So that was a big learning and a big KPI for us.
I think a big mistake most founders do is not trying to understand the numbers. So they measure, of course, maybe with Google Analytics or Mixpanel or anything like that. And the most biggest issue is they don't really get the numbers they're actually measuring or what the tool says. So what are tools you like to use for measuring?
Well, everything, we sort of have like our database is basically Google spreadsheet, to be honest with you. And everything is connected with Zapier, which is, you know, a tool how you can connect. It's sort of a connection between APIs that, you know, that you can use by like drag and drop. Yeah. It's really easy to use. And then to visualize data, we use Google Data Studio. So basically, we use everything that is free. you obviously have to set it up in a way, but it worked pretty good for us. And especially Google Sheets, everyone has it, everyone can use it. So that's the tool that we have, yeah.
Yeah. With your product in the beginning, you had also an iOS and an Android app. Do you still have an app, like a mobile app for your virtual trade fair?
Yeah, we actually do. Now it's on the store owner side. So as a store owner, imagine running a shop. Usually Tuesday morning is really low, you know, because everyone is working. No one will be in your shop. You're going to be pretty bored, you know, by that time. So you're doing like taxes and something, and then sometimes someone comes in. So you have to be in the shop, but you can't really browse for new products. Well, now you can because you're using our app. That's what we developed the app for, because all of the shop owners either have their phone or they have sort of like their cashier thing, their counter running on an iPad. We found that out, so we developed a native app for that, and it's mostly actually iOS because every shop owner seems to have an iPad somehow.
And also like every like second restaurant has an iPad as well, most of the time at least.
Yeah,
it's totally crazy, I get you. So, well, talking about the actual current business, how do you acquire the retailers? Do you only like go to retailers you already have, or do you acquire like with cold calling again, or going into the businesses like in real, like an offline way of acquiring customers, or any other kind of acquisition channel?
That did change a lot. I was in probably around 1,000 local shops with an iPad in my hand pitching our product. That was the first year and a half. That was a lot of like, I'm not going to do that again. I think it's really good for sort of character building, you know, because you learn to handle rejection, you learn to ask for what you want, you learn to ask for a price. But it's enough now, I'm 31, you know, I'm not going to do that again. What we do is, you know, basically we run ads. So the biggest spend that we have in our company is Facebook ads. So as we have a platform where we have to get two customer groups on, the store side is basically an almost completely automated sales funnel that we run through Facebook. We do have a sales agency doing calls with a couple of people that are that fall through the funnel. There are a couple of cases where that can happen, and we actually call them because we found out that's sort of like the three or four cases where it makes sense because it's profitable. And on the other side, for the brand side, it's also an online funnel, but it's not fully automated. It's basically how you know it from, I don't know, SAP or Salesforce. If you want to talk to them, you sign up for a demo and you tell them what time, you know, the time slot, and they call you. That's basically what we do as well.
All right. So like on a webinar or something like that.
Yeah, it's actually Yeah, it's not a webinar. It's actually an actual salesperson talking to you,
yeah.
being very, you know, spending about between 30 and 45 minutes per lead, which is actually a lot, but we have a really high conversion on that. So I think our overall lead conversion on the brand side is about 30% with the call. So that's actually a lot.
So it's like actually only a phone call, not showing the product itself or...
What we actually do is we send them login credentials.
Yeah.
So they can log in themselves and actually feel the product and see it.
Mm-hmm.
We were doing sort of like a Zoom talk before that.
Yeah.
And the thing is, you know, imagine you're a brand from the UK and then some random German, you know, calls you. You have no idea if that company actually exists or if that product, you know, before you give them €1,000.
Yeah.
So basically we have like test accounts that we send out and they can use it for free and just, you know, see how the whole thing is working.
Yeah.
And that's been working pretty well because it's just sort of like a trust factor that you have, you know. I would feel the same way if someone was, you know, trying to acquire me from the UK. I would actually, you know, want something in my hands, and that's why we send out test accounts.
Makes totally sense, actually, if you think about it.
Yeah.
Awesome. I mean, you also talked a little bit about pricing. Currently, your target group on the actual paying customer side is a lifestyle brand still, or
actually both customer sides pay. Even the stores do.
All right.
Reason for that being is, there's actually two reasons for that. One is we're not funded, and the other reason is, you know, if you give out something for free, people tend to not use it. Obviously,
that's true.
I would never, you know, be on the cheap side for a product ever again.
Mm-hmm.
It just makes, you know, you have customers not paying for a product but still generating, you know, support effort. So that just usually doesn't work. It doesn't work for the companies that I, you know, thought about or was participating in. So, but that is, they pay the sort of like the lower price. Sort of like how you have it on a trade fair. If you attend a trade fair and you go there as a you know, potential customer, you usually spend like €5 or something. If you're an exhibitor, it's really expensive. So a trade fair for an exhibitor is at least €10,000. If you put in perspective that they have to get all the clothes down there, they have to have someone, you know, actually sleeping there for 3 nights and something like that, have to build a stand and all that.
Yeah.
On our platform, it's, you know, between 130 and €200 a month. That's kind of the price range we're in.
Yeah.
So if you calculate it down to how much money does a brand spend on a new potential wholesaler, we are about 10 times more cost efficient than a regular trade fair is.
Did you figure a way maybe out to acquire your exhibitors through only online channels?
Yeah, that's how we do it. You know, it's Facebook ads. Well, they sign up for a demo call, you know, so that's our actual connection that we have them. And once they are customers, we even have very close like calls with them. So our customer service has, we sort of have just built that.
Yeah.
So we still do a lot of calls. It's not completely automated because the product is new and you actually have to show them how to use it.
Yeah.
It's kind of, you can imagine this kind of using Facebook ads. Most of the people that do it, don't do it right, so it doesn't really generate any revenue for them, so they stop.
Mm-hmm.
But the market for Facebook is really big, so it doesn't matter too much. Our market is not as big, so we have to show people how to use it.
Yeah, it makes totally sense. So how did you, like the €10,000, I assume for a year or something, right?
The €10,000 would be for a trade fair, but on our platform you pay between 100 and €200 a month.
Right.
So that's about 1,000, you know, which is about the tenth of the price on what you spend on a trade fair for 2 days.
All right. What I'm curious about is, how did you figure out the right pricing for your actual clients or like the brand clients? Because usually it's really hard for a startup or in general a business to figure out what way should actually price their product or service for. Because they don't have a feeling for it.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you're not really sure if people really pay that money for it, you know?
To be honest with you, we changed our price a lot.
Yeah.
And we mostly increased it.
So did you run experiments?
We did. I mean, that is really simple for a product that, you know, sells a lot in a month. If you have a product that you sell once a month, it's really hard to measure something. So for us, it's, you know, about... I don't know, it was about 30 new subscriptions on the brand side, for example, a month. So it was just enough that we could do significant tests.
Yeah.
To be honest with you, I think, and what I have read is, if you have 20% or less of the people you talk to telling you the pricing is too high, even though you have framed it and, you know, done everything right, then it may really be too high. Mm-hmm. If it's below 20% of the people telling you, you know, it's too high, stay with it. Mm-hmm. If you see like, okay, every second person tells me it's too expensive, then it's probably too high. But I would definitely always start on the higher priced end.
Yeah.
You know, everyone really shies away from higher numbers, but it doesn't really make sense, because if you think about the mindset, if you sell something really cheap and you have a good product, then you don't acquire enough money to spread the good product, you know, throughout the whole market. So it doesn't really make sense to sell it for a really cheap ticket.
Yeah. So what was your biggest mistake in all that journey you already shared with us? Like, what was your biggest fuck up, and actually, what did you learn about it?
Yeah, so when we were still, you know, when Findling was still a platform, or it still kind of is, you can still use it that way, but, you know, sort of in the beginning, we were still trying to get end consumers, you know, to find new resellers. I had the idea of bringing a chat to the app. So my idea was you could chat with a store owner about a product. To get back to the example of your shoes, you know, you Google the shoes, you end up on our website, you end up with a shop that has those shoes, so you can ask them if he has your size or and if they are blue. Mm-hmm. And I thought about, you know, it would be sort of like a conversation between the store owner and a person just you at home, but it would kind of feel like, you know, actual shopping. That didn't work out at all. People weren't using it. The stores were kind of annoyed, you know, they would answer too slow, and it wouldn't really work out. And the problem why it didn't work out, it wasn't only the feature. It was that about 95% of the development time of the whole feature was spent on developing the feature, but about 50% of the time should have been spent on go to market. How do we advertise it? How do we get people to use it? Mm-hmm. Not how do we build the, you know, a sort of technique behind it and all that stuff. I think that's a big mistake that a lot of people do. They just think the product is way more important than it actually is. Mm-hmm. Product has to be right, but your go-to-market is just really, really important. And I think that's what I took away from it. And it cost us a lot of money. And if my co-founder, Katharina, hears this, I'm really sorry about this.
Actually, it's a pretty interesting learning, because I think most founders I've met so far tried to over-engineer their product, mm-hmm. before actually going to the market, mm-hmm. or focusing on actually figuring out if the target market is really interested in the product or will adapt it and will use it. You know, mm-hmm. like, because if you think about it, most of the time you really invest so much time in a product, and at the end you figure out that no one will use it.
Yeah.
And I think this is probably one of the hardest lessons every entrepreneur out there has to do and feel, because at the end, like, if you go into the market for an MVP and try to figure out if people will really use it,
yeah,
and like even maybe fake your product in the beginning, you will figure out if it's really worth it and people feel like you feel, because people are sometimes convinced that they are the actual measure.
Mm-hmm.
But as you said, like, it's important what the KPIs say.
Yeah.
And if the KPIs say no way, it's probably maybe the wrong timing,
yeah,
or the wrong market, or in general, a bad idea maybe even.
Yeah. So, I think The Lean Startup is a really good book for that, because it sort of teaches you how you can test your assumptions without having any money. And that is, even if you have money, that's a really good way of, you know, doing it. Testing something and then, you know, just running a test without actually having a product. Even now when I'm testing new ideas, we actually build the sales funnel first, mm-hmm. And start with that and just see, you know, what comes back, and then talk to the people about it, and then even give out the product for free to the, even if they have to sign up for it and it seems like they're paying, we'd sometimes even give out the product for free. But the customer would always be in the position when he decides for it, he would feel like he's paying for a product. Mm-hmm. So we can actually that measure, and then we'd call them up and be like, hey, this one is for free, you know? But we actually test the sales part first before we develop something. And that was a big learning for me.
Yeah. Awesome. So how do you right now tackle the user retention, because I believe it's also like one important thing, not only acquiring users,
yeah,
but also like letting them. I think price, you said, is one thing because people pay for it, so they use it.
Mm-hmm.
But how do you like make them being active and, mm-hmm. and maybe offer them some values, maybe even develop your product further, like for your users and not like just ideas you have and stuff like
yeah.
that?
We did have, you know, a churn problem at one stage in our journey. We sort of had like a leaking bucket situation, you know, mm-hmm. where customers were coming in, but actually falling through the system. I think there's two things that I really took from it. The one thing is try to find out what the metrics in your product are that make your customer happy. For us, it's, you know, a brand on our platform is happy when he generates new resellers for his products. So that's what we measure. That's our most important KPI.
Mm-hmm.
And the second thing is start thinking about getting a customer to book again as a sales task. So we have a customer success team now, or we're just building one.
Yeah.
And it's actually using a CRM. Again, you know, because this is a sales task, you know, you have to talk to the customer, you have to make him happy, you have to get him to book again, basically. So that's the two things that I really learned. Customer success is hugely important.
Mm-hmm.
And when you think about it, I think what isn't really rational, if you think about big telecommunication companies, for example, they spend a lot of money on generating new clients, but they don't spend a lot of money on, you know, keeping a client. And the customer acquisition cost for a new client is so high that it just makes more sense to have a good customer success team to really over-deliver your product, because you save so much money on holding a customer as opposed to generating a new one.
Mm-hmm. So if you think about your whole journey, did you do anything unusual in like growth strategies to like grow your product or users, or letting the product be known from people at least, so you can see how your product is like going on the market? Anything
like a growth
out of the typical like tactics, you know,
kind of like a growth hacking strategy?
Yeah, maybe.
We kind of did. My co-founder is really like Katharina, my co-founder, always wanted to be to have like a local shopping event. It's called mm-hmm. the Shop Local Day.
Yeah.
And that's like her heart project. She loves that.
Yeah.
And it isn't really our core value, because what we do is we are a digital trade fair. But it turned out it was so easy to acquire new shops through an event. It yeah. was way cheaper than running ads on a digital trade fair. So the event actually is profitable for us because we have sponsors sponsoring it. It's a really good deal for them. For the last event, it was iZettle, for example, which have just been acquired by PayPal.
Yeah.
And was really good for them because they were exposed to a lot of local stores, so it really helped them. And it was profitable for us, and it really helped us acquiring new customers. So it's a lot of work, but it's really fun to do an event.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like a sort of offline thing that you do in a digital world, and we really had fun doing it, and it was a huge point in growing the customer base.
I think there's a saying like do things that don't scale, so I think it sounds a little bit like it, but I also believe regarding your target group, it's also about relationships and the events and meeting people. It builds trust.
Yeah.
So I believe it's also one part of a thing why that works maybe better than other stuff, right?
Probably, yeah. It really builds trust. You know, that's something, trust, that's also my co-founder. I can't really measure that, but it's completely true. You know, it really helps. You can sort of measure that by retention and by positive communication on our social media platforms. And, you know, in and around that event, it's just really nice what shop owners say. You know, usually on social media you get hate because only people that are negative, you know, are on social media, but then it's actually like really nice. People love what we're doing, and that's a really cool thing. It also really helps you with, you know, staying motivated,
yeah,
I think, for the whole thing.
So how would you describe the mission of your, well, let's just say new focus?
Well, there was a time of like offline trade fairs. Now it's the time of digital trade fairs. I'm pretty sure. I know there are a lot of digital trade fairs, you know, just like sort of like jumping up, coming up. And in the end, there will be one really big digital trade fair in Europe, and that's going to be Fairling.
Mm-hmm. Pretty ambitious, but also pretty great. So, probably my last question. Is there anything else I should have asked you?
What I think is sometimes really interesting is probably a lot of people listening to this will know Tim Ferriss, you know, because very famous in the podcast world. He has a thing that he does in the end of his podcast, which are called rapid fire questions.
Yeah.
And it's like 5 or 10 really quick questions that I think are really, really cool. And there's one thing that he asks, where he basically asks everyone, if you had a big billboard all around town and you could write something on it,
yeah,
what would that be?
So what would that be?
Yeah, the thing is, I didn't really think about that, you know? But to be honest with you, what would that be? Well, for me, because that's just in what I believe in, is find a system, because that's how I look at things. I always try to find a system behind it, and that's just what I'm hugely passionate about it. Yeah. And I think it just works for business really, really good. It also works for, you know, if you want to make people happy, just, you know, think about what makes them happy. Just try to find a system, and then, you know, run the system. That's what I would advise for people to do.
So run the system would be on the billboard.
Yeah, or find the system. Do that. Sort of be passionate about finding, you know, finding sort of things that, you know, how does the system run? It's always a really cool thing to do. Even when you're in a cafe, think about how does this system work? You know, that's like what I'm passionate about. And maybe some other people are as well, if they, you know, get into the habit of thinking that way.
Pretty awesome message, I have to say. So, well, Florian, let me try to summarize all what you said. I mean, there was a lot, but let me try my best. First of all, of course, KPIs matter. So if you run a startup, try to measure your KPIs and figure out what the most important KPIs are. And of course, check your vanity metrics and stuff like that. Also, like, focus on the go-to-market strategy and less to, well, over-engineering your product. Sometimes it's probably a great idea to directly figuring out if the product is really working. Let people try your product actually and less like webinars and stuff like that. I think that's actually a great way of thinking, that people try to feel your product, especially with software. It's like easy to show, of course, like trade fairs, actual trade fairs.
Yeah.
So of course, they always show their product, but if you can really try it out, you will always know better if it's a great idea for yourself. So I like that a lot. If people pay for a product, they are, of course, more eager to use it. If I think about a lot of tools I use in the past, some of them I have to admit I didn't really use and it was a free product. So I have to actually like go with that mindset, because if people really pay for it,
they
eventually use it. And of course, customer success is actually a key for user retention. And last but not least, events are a great way of, user acquisition or acquisition in general, and also a great way of doing things that don't scale.
Yeah.
So Florian, thank you for all your time and for sharing all that knowledge with us and your insights. And for all the people out there, stay tuned and, well, hope you're here soon.